This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Russia pounded Ukraine's southern cities with drones and missiles for another night, keeping Odessa in its crosshairs after a bitter dispute over the end of a wartime deal that allowed Ukraine to send grain through the key Black Sea port. Ukrainian officials said that the strikes killed at least two people, at least 19 people, including a child, were injured in a nearby city. Russia has targeted Ukrainian critical grain export infrastructure since it vowed retribution this week for an attack that damaged a crucial bridge between Russia and the Moscow-annexed Crimean Peninsula. The strikes have helped drive up food prices in countries facing hunger. A gunman opened fire on a terrified workers on a construction site in downtown Auckland, killing two people hours before New Zealand hosted the first game of the Women's World Cup. The man was found dead, and authorities said that his motive appeared to be connected to his previous work at the site. New Zealand Prime Minister Chris Hipkins said the shooting was an isolated act, and the FIFA tournament opened as scheduled with a game between the home team and Norway, though with tighter security and many jarred in a country where such attacks are rare. A large crowd still showed up at the stadium, where a moment of silence was held for the victims of the shooting. It also left a police officer and four civilians injured. Japanese, U.S., and South Korean senior officials condemned North Korea for its recent ICBM ballistic missile launches. At a meeting in Japan, they vowed to step up their trilateral cooperation to strengthen deterrence and sanctions against the North, while stressing the need for dialogue with Pyongyang. The U.S. Special Representative for North Korea said the U.S. is working hard to gather information about an American soldier who fled to the North. Kim and his Japanese counterpart and South Korean are also discussing their leader summit. This is VOA News. Protesters, angered by an Iraqi man in Sweden who threatened to burn a copy of the Quran, stormed the Swedish embassy in Baghdad. They overran the diplomatic compound early Thursday and started a fire. Hours later, Iraq's prime minister cut diplomatic ties with Sweden in protest over the desecration of the Islamic holy book. Protesters occupied the diplomatic post for several hours. They waved flags and signs showing the influential Iraqi Shiite cleric and political leader Muqtada al-Sadr. The embassy staff was evacuated a day earlier. As global warming pushes temperatures up, the elevation range where malaria-carrying mosquitoes thrive is rising. Researchers have found evidence of the phenomenon from the tropical highlands of South America to the mountainous populous regions of eastern Africa. Scientists now worry that people living in areas once inhospitable to the insects, including the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro and the mountains of eastern Ethiopia, could now be newly exposed to the disease. The U.S. Supreme Court would have to abide by stronger ethics standards under legislation approved by a Senate Judiciary Committee. Comes in response to recent revelations about donor-funded trips by justices. The bill faced united opposition from Republicans and has little chance to make it through the full Senate. That legislation would set ethics rules for the court and a process to enforce them, including new standards for transparency around recusals, gifts, and potential conflicts of interest. Democrats first published or pushed the legislation after reports earlier this year that the Justice Clarence Thomas participated in luxury vacations and a real estate deal with a top GOP donor. With tourism reaching or surpassing pre-pandemic levels across southern Europe this summer, iconic sacred sites struggle to find ways to accommodate both the faithful who come to pray and millions of increasingly secular visitors. Developing strategies to have visitors and faithful go separate ways, with services held in discrete places visited, barred, and worshipful spaces retain their spiritual purposes. The aim is to make them available to worshipers, but also to educate tourists about their history as sacred sites, especially in rapidly secularizing countries where less famous churches are emptying out. You'll find more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, July 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan opposition protesters took to the streets for a second day yesterday, Thursday.
Every part of Kenya have said we cannot sabotage our economy using violence and destruction of business and destruction of property. Kenya is the only place we have to call home.
Is there a split in Uganda's main opposition FDC? Malawi's vice president wants his bail conditions eased. We'll speak with a female presidential candidate in Liberia's October elections. The M23 rebels in DRC deny they censored the media.
I sent a message to them and I told them we need to stop broadcasting people that bring hate speeches. So we don't control the program.
And Liberia responds to the mysterious death of 36 cows near the Sierra Leone border. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Protesters were out in the streets in Kenya again on Thursday, demonstrating against the high cost of living and recent tax hikes. This comes after opposition leader Raila Odinga called for a three-day demonstration that started on Wednesday. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief Maria Madialo reports.
Protesters showed up for a second day in a row in some parts of Nairobi and elsewhere in the country against what they say is a cost of living that's been drastically going up each and every day. The three-day demonstrations that started on Wednesday and led by opposition leader Raila Odinga have seen 300 people reportedly arrested, including several senior opposition leaders. Some were in court on Thursday to respond to accusations of looting, assaulting police, and destroying property. One police officer masqueraded as a reporter to arrest a protester, says David Amwoyo, the head of Kenya's Media Council.
What we saw was a policeman in civilian clothing who was among the journalists, the press corps, during demonstrations in one of the suburbs in Nairobi. And then suddenly he put his camera phone in the pocket and jumped across, grabbed one of the protesters and dragged him across. Then the other policeman immediately joined him. I think it was like a setup. And then he grabbed one protester and then threw him into their police vehicle.
Amwoyo told VOA this is the first of its kind and it's scary for members of the media.
Our fear is that the perception of the protesters or the public that police could masquerade as journalists, because we have had running battles between police and protesters with a few projectile stones thrown at each other. Then the protesters, who of course agitated and angry with the tear gas and all that, could end up attacking members of the press and journalists, accusing them of being the police.
Kenyan President William Ruto, addressing residents of Isiolo County on Thursday, urged residents to maintain peace, saying that destruction of property during the demonstrations will affect development of the country.
Every part of Kenya have said we cannot sabotage our economy using violence and destruction of business and destruction of property. Kenya is the only place we have to call home, and we must protect it by all means.
On Thursday, veteran opposition leader Odinga wrote on Twitter, "The voice of the people must be heard," and insisted the peaceful protest continue. Vincent Kimosop, an economic policy and governance expert based in Nairobi, says it's important to analyze the impact of recent events.
If you look at the impact of the disruptions that were brought by the war in Ukraine, the disruption of the global supply chains with COVID-19, and for close to 2 years, we shut the engines of economic production while at the same time pushing into subsidies, allowing people to access monies. So the monies that are being pushed to facilitate people through such situation, of course, when you shut down economic engines, what happens? You are basically preparing for inflation.
The protests are expected to continue Friday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
A spokesperson for the M23 rebels operating in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo says the group did not ban a radio program produced by displaced journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists this week accused the M23 of censorship by banning the current affairs show called Sauti ya Wahami that is broadcast on Top Congo FM. M23 political spokesperson Lawrence Kanyuka says the group does not censor what radio stations should or should not report. However, Kanyuka tells me that he sent a letter to Top Congo FM on July 14 asking the station to stop carrying the program until there is a review on August 10th. Kanyuka says the M23 wants the show to stop hosting people who preach hatred and division.
First of all, let me tell you, we don't ban any radios purposely for other reason than the coalition of communities living together. So all the radios, including Voice of America's and all stations, are broadcast. No, all radios in our area. It is only Top Congo, which is a radio sponsored by the DRC government, that spread hatred and division, exclusion. That's why we said we don't want to carry on with propaganda of division, hate speech, genocide, ideology, broadcast within the area. We even contacted the Top Congo. We told them that we actually don't want division. So the hate speech is at a level where it's become toxic. That's why we said we need to prevent all these things getting out of proportion. So therefore, we told Top Congo to wait for the time being.
But Lawrence, the report here says that on July 14, you sent letters to four, I think it's Radio Horizon, FM, Radio Communicator, Radio Alliance, and Radio Rakov to stop carrying the program. Is that correct?
I've already sent a message to the radio station to stop for the time being until we have a review on the 10th of August. I sent the message to them and I told them we need to stop broadcasting people that are bringing hate speeches. So we don't control the programs. They actually publish everything they published, but we request for us to bring the living together to stop hate speech. That's why we said this program that comes from Goma and the DRC government side of control of countries, bringing stuff back to the area we are, I said, okay, let us have a review. So we're going to meet on the 10th of August for us to discuss together what is the way forward, what we really want.
Lawrence Kanyuka is the political spokesperson for M23 Rebels in DRC. He was speaking with me from Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Malawi's Vice President Saulos Chilima has asked the court to vary some of his bail conditions in his corruption case. A chief resident magistrate court in Malawi released Chilima on bail last year, soon after the Anti-Corruption Bureau arrested him in November. He was charged with allegedly receiving payments amounting to $280,000 and other items from British businessman Zunef Sattar in return for the award of Malawi government contracts. However, Chilima's lawyers told the court on Wednesday that the bail conditions were not reasonable. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Among the bail conditions were that Chilima should be reporting to the Anti-Corruption Bureau offices once every 3 months. He should also surrender his travel documents to court and seek approval before he travels outside the country. Kumbo Soko is one of the Chilima's lawyers. He told reporters outside the Financial Crimes Court that the bail conditions do not serve any purpose except to humiliate Chilima.
The argument we're presenting is that if you look at the caliber of the defendant who is in court, the high office which he occupies, there can be no suspicion that he's going to run away. You know, so there's, to that extent, therefore, no justification for having these conditions, you know, unless perhaps there's something else that we're seeking to achieve, maybe just to humiliate him. He goes to the ACB, he meets exceptionists. For what?
Soko also said there was no need for Chilima to surrender his travel documents because he is always surrounded by security officers, which guarantees his availability. However, the presiding judge, Redson Kapindu, wondered if the vice president would not request security around him for privacy. Kareke Nikapale, another defense lawyer, responded by saying Chilima cannot ask for privacy for 3 months. Chilima is facing 6 counts of corrupt practices by a public officer, profiting from government contracts and failing to make full report to the officers of the bureau. In June of last year, Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera suspended the powers of the Vice President Chilima after his arrest. Anti-corruption bureau lawyer Crispin Kunga objected to the changes in the application of Chilima's bail, saying the conditions were reasonable. He cited as an example of another former vice president of Malawi, Kasim Chilumba, who was arrested for treason. His travel documents were surrendered and he was required to visit the police station every week. In response, the presiding judge Kabindu asked why the ACB would not rely on police in the Chilima case. The ACB said this case is different. Hilary Chilumba is Deputy Director General for the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
We're saying that no to the violation of bail, opposing the application which was done by our colleagues. So we're satisfied with the way the arguments have taken place. We should respect the lower courts, which actually came up with the bail conditions, because when the court was coming on the decision, they knew that it was the vice president. So we stick to that. On the other issue, of course, you argue to say that this is a new case in Malawi.
The presiding judge, Redison Kabindu, said he would make a ruling on the matter in early August, when Chilima is expected to take a plea to charges leveled against him. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, July 21st. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Once again, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story that you connected with. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. Once again, the WhatsApp number is +1 202 258 3076. +1 202 258 3076. And we thank you for 60 years of support. There is a big split in one of Uganda's largest opposition parties, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, between top leaders supporting founding President Dr. Chisa Besigye and others backing current President Patrick Oboy Amura. One analyst says the division weakened the party. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala.
The two factions convened separate press briefings this week, counter-choosing each other of either hobnobbing with the ruling party, the NRM, or National Platform. FDC spokesman Semuju Nganda accused the party president for having received unspecified sums of money from Uganda's president during the 2021 general elections. He accuses others of intending to cause chaos within the party. FDC party president Patrick Oboy Amuriat vehemently denies he received funds from the ruling party. He instead accused other faction for failing to rally support for him.
I was abandoned by people I worked with. I ran a lone campaign supported by a few fearless and committed comrades. And I wish to thank them so dearly for standing above self-interest.
David Pulkol, the executive director of the political think tank, the Africa Leadership Institute, warns that leaders have to resist from attacking each other if they are to attract more party support.
If you don't trust the others, why should others trust you? So people should get away, should desist from such toxic communication. You should emphasize more on the positive.
Amuriat agrees. He says he hopes the two sides will reconcile and dialogue.
Such diversity is common in any organization similar to the FDC. And it often leads to healthy internal discussions, engagements, and better decision-making.
Earlier on Thursday, there was commotion at party headquarters as the party chairman, Ambassador Wasa Ovirigwa, was reportedly held hostage by the faction belonging to Amuriat. He was captured on video, jumping the fence as he escaped from alleged captivity. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Until recently, Sarah Beslow Nyanti served as the Deputy Special Representative of the UN Secretary General and Resident Coordinator of the UN Mission in South Sudan. Now she has declared her candidacy for president in Liberia's October election. Beslow Nyanti tells me that she wants to use her vast experience to benefit Liberians, as she has done in other countries.
All of the skills and experiences and talents that I have and all of the work that I've done and learned in terms of poverty reduction, in terms of lifting people out of poverty, in terms of developing policies that actually address the immediate needs of the people, job creation, better health care, and so forth. I want to be able to use that to benefit the Liberian people as I have done in other countries.
Some people say, well, why did it take you so long to enter the race?
Everything is a process, and this is not about an event. This is not just about October 10th. This is about a lifelong commitment to ensure that I put my hands to the plow and now commit all that I have to helping to resolve the issues and solve the problems that we face as Liberians.
What do you think are your chances? Because there are some Liberians who may feel that you are not well known in Liberia, or should I say that you are just testing the waters for future elections?
Nobody enters a process like this with an intention to lose. So I've entered with an intention to win. But I also am very cognizant of the fact that it's not only about the result, the process matters. And what I hope to do is to add value to the process, to be able to be a voice for the voiceless, to be able to raise the bar on the issues, the discussion on how we solve the problems. I'm not convinced that every Liberian has already decided before now. Many have told me that they had decided not to vote in this election because they felt that they didn't have the alternative that they wanted. Entering this to the Liberian people know that there are alternatives and there are people who can solve their problems, to work along with them, to identify the issues, to solve the issues with them, and together to build the nation.
I had planned to do a story about women participation in this electoral process. So now that I have you, what can you tell us about women participation in Liberian politics?
What I can say is that we need women's participation across all aspects of leadership in Liberia. And the reality is that women continue to bear the brunt of all of the development challenges. Right now, over 90% of female employment in Liberia is vulnerable employment. Women in informal employment compared to men are less, and women continue to suffer the situation that we find in Liberia. And I'm saying it's very important for women who understand the issues that women face to be at the table at every level of our polity.
Sarah Beslow Nyanti is a presidential aspirant in Liberia's October 10 elections. She was speaking with me in transit to Liberia. Earlier this week, Sierra Leone banned the movement of livestock and meat imports from neighboring Liberia following the mysterious death of 36 cows near the border. The Sierra Leone government said it was stepping up surveillance for possible anthrax. Liberian authorities said the cattle deaths began in July near the town of Kelima Bendu in Lofa County. Liberia's Agriculture Minister, Jenny Cooper, says an investigation concluded the cows did not die from anthrax as was suspected. Instead, she tells me that the plausible explanation for the animal's death could have been a lightning strike.
Immediately the reports came out, we started getting reports from Ghana, from other countries, saying that they had discovered anthrax in some cattle. So, of course, that caused a level of panic in populations. So we sent out a team of technicians led by our Central Veterinary Lab Director technicians from the Ministry of Health, from the National Public Health Institute of Liberia, and they were backed up by FAO and WHO and some World Bank regional surveillance to see what was happening. They went up there and they took soil samples, water samples from the drinking areas, tissue samples from the live and the dead animals, blood samples, and they brought it down for testing. And the results came back with no traces of anthrax, no traces of brucellosis, which are the two main zoonotic diseases that we were worried about, and no traces of pesticide residue. In fact, that area, there's no farm nearby. Meanwhile, Sierra Leone issued a ban on Liberian cattle.
Is there a cross-border trade in cows between Liberia and Sierra Leone? How did the ban come about?
Well, we have over 500 unmanned border points between Liberia and its neighbors. If there's a cross-border trade in cows between Liberia and Sierra Leone, it's negligible. And as I say, we're not a cattle-rearing country. So cows is not something that we are busy trading. They chose to issue the ban, but it's not just for cattle coming from Liberia into Sierra Leone, but also for three districts in Sierra Leone.
That was Jenny Cooper, Liberia's agriculture minister, speaking with me from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Umale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup, which got underway on Thursday. President of the Confederation of African Football, Dr. Patrice Motsepe, has conveyed a message of encouragement to the African countries participating at the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup. Dr. Motsepe has urged them to follow the impressive example set by Morocco, who achieved a historic milestone by reaching the semi-finals of the men's tournament a few months ago. South Africa, Morocco, Nigeria, and Zambia are the four countries that will represent the African continent at the Global Showpiece, which got underway in Australia and New Zealand on Thursday.
We are confident that the nations that are representing us in Australia and New Zealand, the women's FIFA Women's World Cup, the African nations will make us proud, and we wish them all of the best. We are behind them and we are very proud of them.
And now to rugby, where the Nigeria senior men rugby national team, the Black Stallions, have been drawn in Pool B of the African Men's Rugby Sevens Olympic qualifiers. The Black Stallions of Nigeria will take on the Shujaa of Kenya, the Welwitchers of Namibia and Zambia for a place in the quarterfinal of the tournament. The Black Stallions of Nigeria will be aiming for the automatic ticket if they can get their best legs in Europe and America to be part of the team for the qualifiers in Zimbabwe. The Olympic qualifiers will hold from September 16th to the 17th at the Harare Sports Club, Zimbabwe. And now to cricket, where Tanzania will host the 2024 ICC Under-19 Men's Cricket World Cup qualifiers, where six countries, Kenya, Sierra Leone, Uganda, Nigeria, Namibia, and Tanzania, will battle it out in the capital of Dar es Salaam from July 23rd to July 30th. The Dar Gymkhana Club Ground and the University of Dar es Salaam will be the venues for the qualifiers. Alan Mugume, who is the CEO of Uganda Cricket Association, says the Uganda Under-19 cricket team, known as the Baby Cranes, will be looking to edge out the competition that includes Namibia, who they face in the opener on Sunday.
I'm not only hoping and praying that they actually take the slot, the only slot available for grabs in this tournament. I'm actually highly confident that that slot belongs to us. The boys have worked very, very hard, and everything looks positive.
In basketball news, Egypt and Angola on Thursday booked their spot in the semifinals of the ongoing FIBA Under 16 Africa Championship. The two countries joined Mali and Guinea, who had earlier qualified for the semifinals on Wednesday. Angola defeated Chad 86-74 to earn its third semifinal berth in the history of the championship. While Egypt survived the first quarter 22-20 score from Rwanda to pick a semifinal spot in a game that ended 94-78 in favor of the Egyptians. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you